You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special offer.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Monster House presents
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
Hey there, Monster Talkers. Karen and I are pleased to announce that we're joining the Airwave Podcast Network. This is going to lead to more regular release schedule, which I know many of you have asked for a long while. And I can tell you that for the first time in our history, I have a backlog of recorded episodes and a published release schedule for us to work from. Stand by, because we're going to be attempting to be bi-weekly and regular. Let's see how we do. If all goes well, we'll be on an every other Monday schedule, and we're very excited at that prospect. And if you heard ads at the start of the show, then you're already getting the new feed. It may take a little while for all these changes to trickle in, but I've been working very hard behind the scenes to make sure all the nitty-gritty work is being done to make this happen.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Welcome to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
In this bonus episode, we're far adrift from the science show of our tagline, but we're definitely into monsters. We're going to be hearing from Mike Mason at Chaosium. When I got to college, a friend of mine told me about the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, based on the works of H.P. Lovecraft. I may have been one of the only one of my friends to come to this game from already knowing his work, but soon we were all saying the nearly unpronounceable names of his pantheon of monstrous otherworldly evil and rattling off the titles of imaginary books of forbidden knowledge. In short, it was a wonderful primer for my lifelong pursuit of understanding the strange and mysterious kinds of stuff that I don't believe in, but sometimes wished were true. Maleficent fish people and subterranean dog-faced ghouls aren't real, but they're the kind of evil you can fight without ambiguity of purpose. Sure, it's just a game, but it was one that valued research over brash action. Surely it's clear at this point that a huge chunk of the findings we talk about on Monster Talk come from me trying to make a successful library role in real life. And my struggles for sanity also feel very true to the game. Anyway, I hope you enjoy this bonus episode while we finish up preparation to fully join the Airwave family of podcasts. You'll hear more about that soon, but for now, let's get to the
Monster Talk.
Today we're talking with Mike Mason of Chaosium, the gaming company that makes the role-playing system most near and dear to my heart, Call of Cthulhu. Mike's promoting the newest version of Chaosium's monstrous bestiary, which is called the Malleus Monstrorum. For the 7th edition of the classic game ecosystem based on the works of H.P. Lovecraft and all kinds of Lovecraft-adjacent horror. So welcome to Monster Talk, Mike Mason.
Thank you. It's great to be here. Hi.
Hello. So it's nice to talk in person, finally. So you are titled as the Call of Cthulhu Creative Directory at Chaosium. Is that right?
Yeah, that I guess that translates into a number of things. I look after the Call of Cthulhu game line for the company, and I have various hats that I wear. So I'm kind of the lead writer for the game. I'm also a commissioning editor. I also commission an art direct as well. And I also get involved in looking after the property in licensing terms. So, you know, we license the Call of Cthulhu game out to foreign translation and other companies to, you know, produce great material to support the game, as well as, you know, add on and support kind of play aids and things like that. But equally, you know, we're involved in licensing in terms of some of the properties that we use in the game, whereas, you know, whilst Lovecraft himself is, pretty much all of his material is in, would be considered to be in the public domain. You know, there are writers that are still living who have contributed to the mythos, who we, you know, we like their, what they've done, and we want to include that in the game. So, you know, people like Brian Lumley and Ramsey Campbell, who obviously, you know, their material is obviously copyright. So we, you know, we license certain aspects of their, you know, Cthulhu Mythos work to include within our kind of, you know, Cthulhu Mythos game. So kind of licensing both sides of it in that sense.
I think it's funny. I thought I was being super clever by, I have a question towards the end of what I have planned here to talk about Ramsey Campbell and Brian Lumley. And I was so proud of myself. And now you've spoiled it.
I'm sorry. Well, yeah, I'm sure you can still.
I'll recover somehow.
Ask it'll anything be on, pertinent that you want. I'll do my best to answer.
So I have lots of questions for you. Now, some of these are coming from me as a host of a show about monsters, but some of them are just because I have probably played more hours of Call of Cthulhu than any other role playing game. I would imagine, and I've played a lot of role playing games, but
yeah,
it was one that I felt relatively safe playing because I was living under these weird rules. My parents were fundamentalist religious people. They didn't want me playing Dungeons and Dragons or anything like that. And I felt like Call of Cthulhu was pretty much not like that. It was quite different.
Yeah.
I'm sure I was skirting the rules, but I described the Malleus Monstrorum as being kind of like the Monster Manual. But since some of our listeners are not role players, maybe we should introduce this hobby. So what is Call of Cthulhu and how is it different from sort of fantasy role-playing games people might have just sort of picked up from in culture in general?
Yeah, sure. Well, the starting point, I guess, is, you know, what is a role-playing game? And that is very much, in one sense, it's a shared story. There is normally one person who kind of runs the game, who's maybe like the referee, you know, gets called various things by different games. In Call of Cthulhu, they're called the Keeper. In Dungeons and Dragons, they're the Dungeon Master. But it's the same kind of role. You guide the story along and present various scenes, encounters, and characters to the players in the game. And the players in the game, they all take on a character. Now, in Dungeons and Dragons, that might be a fighter or a wizard or whatever it may be. But in Call of Cthulhu, you'll play a relatively regular, normal person in a kind of a version of the real world that we live in. So in Call of Cthulhu, if you're playing in a modern day or the 1920s kind of classic era, you could be playing a private detective, you could be playing a librarian, a taxi driver, somebody who works in a store or an office. They're just regular people. And some of them have, you know, expertise in certain things, like a librarian is obviously going to be pretty good at, you know, digging out information, while a private eye may be great, getting information off the street and using contacts. Or you may be a scientist and, you know, your expertise is physics and chemistry. And so you play kind of regular folk in Call of Cthulhu who are basically dropped or presented with dramatic and wild situations they are drawn into And normally that's through some sort of mystery. Starts off as a mystery. Maybe somebody has gone missing, or the museum has been broken into and an item has been stolen. And as a player characters, you are kind of brought into the mystery to try and solve it, basically. And as you get deeper into the mystery, finding clues and information, normally at the heart of the mystery is some sort of, you know, horrific alien horror from the Cthulhu mythos. And that could be a bunch of humans who are kind of worshipping the alien gods of the Cthulhu mythos and working as a kind of cult to, you know, cause something bad to happen. Or it could be the appearance of sort of a monster, you know, from the spaces between the stars has appeared on the earth, and, you know, you've got to try and deal with it. And the big difference between Call of Cthulhu and many other kind of games that are more fantasy based is, in the fantasy games, you know, you're pretty, you know, most of the time, pretty well equipped to take on monsters and normally kill them in some regard and steal their treasure. Whereas in Call of Cthulhu, you're playing fragile humans who don't get more powerful in terms of their hit points and strength and all that kind of thing. They all stay the same because, you know, like in real life, my health doesn't go up as I get older. It gets worse. It kind of mirrors that kind of sense of reality, I sense, I guess. And so heading into a big fight with these, you know, horrors from Lovecraft stories and so on is normally a very quick way to get yourself killed as a character. So the game kind of presents to you options to sort of say, well, you know, is there another way you can deal with this monster? Maybe you can't kill it because it's immune to bullets and fire. So maybe you've got to think around other ways to, you know, deal with it, which could be, you know, banishing it with maybe trying to find some magic or something that could maybe banish the creature or destroy it. Maybe there's some sort of special warding you can create or find that can kind of imprison it, so at least it's not a problem anymore. So it kind of gets you to think on your feet and present you with kind of information to try and come up with, you know, novel ways to deal with these problems. And sometimes you can't deal with them, and you just have to do the best you can. And sometimes the best you can is to run away and hope you can find something down the road and come back later to deal with it. I mean, you know, anything's possible. And then, you know, sometimes, you know, if it's a bunch of, you know, human cultists, well, maybe you can, you know, subdue them all in a combat, or maybe you can get them embroiled and implicated so the police turn up and arrest them all for you, or whatever it may be. But it's quite different from your kind of average fantasy kind of game in that, you know, you're not these powerhouses of lots of spells and, you know, magical swords. You know, you are just regular humans and, you know, dealing with the hand you've been dealt, really.
Yeah, I keep, as a fan of the H.P. Lovecraft fiction, so many of the stories end up with the protagonist about to die or having gone mad. And it's like it's really rare that there's sort of an explosive finish. And I guess maybe Shadow Over Innsmouth might be one. And even that one doesn't really end that way. But there is that scene where the Navy comes in with the big guns.
Of all the Lovecraft stories, the Dunwich horror, it's probably the closest one in terms of what I call a Cthulhu scenario might look like, because you've got a big kind of monster on the roaming around on the loose, and the guys can't, you know, they just can't deal with it in terms of fighting it. So they turn to these old tomes of arcane lore, and they find this kind of banishing spell, and they, you know, they get together and they try and cast this spell to kind of banish the creature. And that's the only way that they can really deal with it. You know, to take it on any other way would probably just mean they all get eaten or something. So, yeah, absolutely.
It's interesting because, I mean, sort of when I started playing Call of Cthulhu, I was enamored of its setting in the 1920s, in the sort of flapper era. And I knew, I was familiar with Delta Green, but I hadn't played that. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, but that's like a separate gaming company, or is that's not actually part of Chaosium, right? The Delta Green stuff, right?
That's right. Yeah. Originally, Delta Green was originally a setting and source material for the Call of Cthulhu game. It was done under license by a company called Pagan Publishing. And that was some years ago. And over time, what the guys at Pagan Publishing did was to kind of basically design their kind of own version of the game that they, you know, they wanted to kind of create around the setting that they've made, which is a very much a modern day setting where you are playing in this kind of government conspiracy, dealing with the you know, cosmic horrors and so forth. And so now it's become its own kind of separate game and is you know, unconnected to Call of Cthulhu in that way. Although there is a lot of historical crossover, and indeed, you know, whilst Delta Green is sort of set in the modern day, you know, the materials can be used in Call of Cthulhu, and likewise, some of the materials in Call of Cthulhu could be used for Delta Green. It shares a common heritage, I guess, in that way.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I mean, at the end of the day, Call of Cthulhu is a very generic game system, as you say. The kind of classic period of play for most games is that kind of 1920s, 1930s era with the you know, the Roaring Twenties, because it's very evocative and fun to play in. But equally, you know, the rule book for Call of Cthulhu gives you everything you need to play in the modern day. If you want to do it in the modern day, and we have supplements for setting the games in the Wild West, in Victorian Europe, in England. We've even got one for the Dark Ages, you know, around 900 AD. And so, you know, it's a very versatile system in terms of being able to adapt to different eras of play. And because the beauty of the Cthulhu mythos is that it exists across time. So wherever you are, the horror still lurks in the darkness, kind of thing.
Exactly. And can you talk a little bit about going insane? Because I think one of the mechanics that I think most people who've played the game find to be most distinctive is this sort of sanity mechanic and the role around, does seeing this stuff drive me mad?
Yeah, most, I mean, Call of Cthulhu was kind of the, you know, certainly the first game, you know, kind of that got a lot of press about it, that that went beyond a character having hit points, having life points in a sense. And it has a, it has those, but also every character has sanity points, because as you know, if you read the kind of the fiction the game is kind of, you know, it derived from, the kind of Lovecraftian stories, as you said earlier, where the kind of protagonists in the stories, you know, they don't normally necessarily die, but they kind of they go insane through the contact they have with the alienness, the cosmic horror of the Cthulhu mythos. And so the sanity mechanic kind of mirrors that literary aspect, and it kind of signifies the corruption of the human, you know, the human mind by the Cthulhu mythos. And so as a character encounters the Cthulhu mythos in its various shapes and forms, you actually lose sanity points. And at certain losses of sanity points, they trigger madness in the character. And there's a thing in the game called a bout of madness, where a character kind of, you know, effectively a player loses control of their character temporarily for a short time, and the character does something, you know, acts out of character and does something potentially risky and harmful to themselves and to their comrades while they're, you know, while having faced some horror from the Cthulhu mythos. And ultimately, just like if a character loses all of their hit points, their character is effectively, you know, physically dead. If they lose all of their sanity points, they become permanently insane, and they're basically crossed over into the light of the Cthulhu mythos, and they become effectively true believers in the mythos, and effectively become, you know, cultists and believers who are, you know, the enemies of the player characters that way. So you can start with a character who could end up becoming an enemy at the end of, you know, at some point down the road, basically. Yeah, it's very much the Cthulhu mythos is a, humanity can learn and can get great power from the Cthulhu mythos, but its touch is burning. And the more you hold on to it, the more it burns away your humanity, basically.
I have to say, as someone who's done decades of paranormal research, even as a skeptic and a non-theist, I think those give you some defense, but this stuff does have an impact on your mental health. I really believe that. It's like, I think if you keep peering into the abyss, yeah, maybe the abyss looks back. And what I've noticed is the abyss is often wearing a Nazi uniform. It's really weird. I don't know what to make of that. But yeah, no, I think this is a good mechanic. I really do. Having played it so long, I just find it wild to read about groups that have had decades-long Call of Cthulhu gaming campaigns. you've probably run into this. What's the longest you've ever heard of someone having a continuous gaming group?
I know people who are still running a campaign that's been going on 10 years or more. The norm, you know, most campaigns, you know, tend to run 6 months to 2 years. That's kind of an average, I guess, if you're running a long form kind of version of the game. The beauty of it is that even though your character may die, they can pass on, you know, their knowledge and to a new character. You know, you can bring in replacement characters effectively. It's like in a horror story, you know, you've got so far in the investigation before the horror catches up with you, but you know, you've diligently been filling in your diary and your journal with everything you found, and now you leave that inheritance to your nephew.
Exactly, that's exactly what I was thinking. Yeah, the World War I vet who's come in to find out what happened to his academic uncle. Exactly.
Yes, that's it. So you get a lot of longevity through characters and their replacements. You know, again, it's this kind of style of game that you and your group want to play. But I mean, Cthulhu can be a lot of combat in it if that's the kind of style of game you want. However, there are many groups that, you know, combat happens very, very rarely. And if it does, you know, the players are shrewd enough to kind of run away and not get involved. And so, you know, live to fight another day. There are, you know, ways to mitigate that. And in fact, there's we have a supplement called Pulp Cthulhu, which basically takes Call of Cthulhu and really kind of injects the kind of the pulp kind of ethos into it. Kind of like if you want to kind of do a more kind of Indiana Jones style kind of version of the game. And so the characters in that are tougher. They've kind of like doubled their hit points, and they have access to kind of special talents and things like that. So just to make them a little bit larger than life. And so their survivability of those characters is greatly enhanced in that way. However, you know, given the nature of the game that it is, it's a horror game, they can still go insane and they can still die if the right, you know, the right or the worst things happen to them in that sense. But character longevity is a kind of very flexible thing in Call of Cthulhu, because we're talking about campaigns, but the game also plays really well as a one-shot kind of game. If you want to kind of do like run a one session, one evening kind of game that's a bit like a horror film, you can do that. And so the characters are all ultimately disposable in the sense of the story. And you're trying to, you know, survive the longest and get to the end and reach a conclusion within the time scale you've got. So, which is a very kind of different style of play to the campaign style, but it, you know, it accommodates both of those things.
Absolutely. I was thinking about, like, campaign wise, I've only run a few campaigns. I've done most of mine as unconnected one shots, although I did have one player who kept playing the same character, which I really loved, which was a reporter character named Scoops Malone, whose signature move was to whip out a camera and do the flashbulb. You know, so he never got a news story with a good photo, but he always like used the flashbulb to escape the monsters, which was a lot of fun.
Fantastic. Yeah, that's great. Yeah, absolutely.
Good fun. So how does this book, The Malleus Monstrorum, fit into the gaming experience? Is this something that the players are supposed to read, or just the keeper, or how does that work?
Well, it is a kind of a source book for the game. While we'd call it a core source book, it isn't. You don't need it to play the game with. It's additional material to help, particularly the keepers who run the games and design the games. But it does have a dual use, even though it's not necessarily something that players of the game would necessarily need to get. It is a useful kind of book for people who are interested in the Cthulhu mythos generally, even if they don't play the game. Even though it's a game book, the material in there, the background on the various kind of monsters and alien deities of the Cthulhu mythos, it provides a kind of, you know, almost like a coffee table kind of book of art and information on the background and lore about these kind of creatures. So that's on one sense a kind of a much more kind of general kind of thing that people, you know, interested in this kind of thing would find, you know, be of interest too. But predominantly I think of it as like a toolkit for people who run Call of Cthulhu and who design scenarios for their groups. And it's a two-volume sort of set that comes in a lovely slipcase. And the first book details all of the kind of the monsters of the Cthulhu mythos. So if anyone's kind of familiar with some of those things, like the Deep Ones of Innsmouth, and the Shoggoths and the Migo, which are all kind of creatures that are featured in, you know, Lovecraft stories, and many, many others as well. Others have come and been invented for the Cthulhu, Call of Cthulhu game. Others come from some of the other writers of the mythos, so Ramsey Campbell, Brian Lumley, and Robert E. Howard, and Clark Ashton Smith, and all these other writers who were, you know, either part and contemporary with Lovecraft, or were, you know, built on those original kind of fictions, you know, up to the present day. So that's book one. It's very much a collection of monsters. There's also a lot of guidance on how to use monsters in the games, how to present them, how to make them scary, and also how to design your own monsters and your own versions of things. And that's all kind of in book one. And then in book two, it looks specifically at all the kind of the Cthulhu mythos deities, the alien gods, the great old ones, the outer gods like Nyarlathotep and Azathoth and Great Cthulhu himself. And it presents contradictory and variant views on all of them. So within one write-up of, say, Great Cthulhu, there's, you know, contradictory information, really, in terms of what humanity knows, because there isn't a canon to this stuff and there isn't a, you know, agreed-upon narrative. This is all, you know, through the lens of rumour and speculation and mystery. And this is kind of, in a fictional sense, it's a kind of a collection of disparate voices who all claim to know what Great Cthulhu is. And none of them actually do know, and no one can prove it either way. So it's it presents a range of ideas that keepers can draw upon to inform their own kind of presentations of the game, and also inform them, you know, in terms of helping them to design, you know, stories and narratives for, you know, scenarios and campaigns, you know, for their own groups in that way. So it's a big collection of monsters, basically.
Yeah.
And hopefully, you know, you can use them in game. You can use them, you know, if you were a, if you wanted to know more about the Cthulhu mythos because you wanted to write for it, or you're an artist, or you just, you know, want to sit there and kind of enjoy the kind of the background of the material, it serves that purpose as well.
Yeah, it's very comprehensive. It's I love the art in it. Can you want to talk about the art? That won't really translate very well into a podcast, but it is quite good. Do you want to talk a little bit about the art?
Yeah, sure. The art has all been done by one person, a French artist who's called Loïc Musy, and he's been working with us for some time. And I kind of asked, would he be interested in just illustrating everything? And he kind of jumped at the chance, and he has illustrated, you know, not every single monster and so forth has an illustration, but obviously many of them do. And Loïc has, you know, done a range of, you know, full color and grayscale pieces for the books, and kind of trying to show, you know, some sense of, you know, visually what they look like, but obviously doing his own kind of spin on it as well, because as I tried to say in the books themselves, when a human sees something from the Cthulhu mythos, they may see something slightly different to the person standing next to them, because they may be multidimensional, and you only see certain aspects and your mind latches onto what you can make sense of. So you might see a snake-headed wolf, and the person next to you might see some sort of giant, you know, crocodile with the head of a bird. I don't know. You know,
yeah. I'm thinking, like, right, especially like with the great old ones, where that whatever you see is what they're physically manifesting here. It's not them. You know, it's not like a Dungeons and Dragons where you fight a dragon, and while that's a really tough fight, but when you kill it, it's a dead dragon. You know, if it's a manifestation of an entity's intelligence from another dimension, and when you kill it, it just turns into vapor and recoalesces, or maybe at best you banish it for X amount of years or weeks or whatever. it's a little different.
Yes, it is. And the books go into, you know, some length in the introductions to try and, you know, present that in understandable terms and in practical terms for the game itself as well. So, Yeah, absolutely. How humanity interacts with the Cthulhu mythos is quite key, because obviously that's very much the nature of what the game is about.
Yeah, I was thinking about the pulp version. Is the pulp version designed to extend into the present day as well as the sort of 1920s?
Yeah, I mean, again, the core setting is around that kind of 1930s era. However, the whole book, whilst based in the 30s, is presented in such a way that you can, you know, use it wholesaling for whatever version of the game you want to play in. So, yeah, you could use it modern day. Equally, you could use it, in the Gaslight era of Victorian England, and obviously it does work pretty well with the Down Darker Trails Wild West setting. You know, where you've got dueling pistols and quick draws and all that kind of thing that kind of, you know, fits very well in that pulp vein. So yeah, it works across the game and its kind of iterations.
Outstanding. And I know as a business you have to be concerned about keeping track of your intellectual property and all that sort of thing. But at the same time, Lovecraft himself worked collaboratively and supported so many writers and seemed to freely allow his creatures and sort of approach to this kind of fiction to be shared, that I know you've got a responsibility to, you know, focus on intellectual property protection, but at the same time, I love how the game lends itself to incorporating monsters from films you just saw or horror stories you just read. It's like, it's super handy to have a book full of all those monsters. But I found that the game's setting itself allowed you to create almost any kind of horror sort of scenario if you wanted to, whether it's connected to the mythos directly or not. But although I do have a bias towards the mythos.
Yeah, no, absolutely. The very heart of the game, it's a horror role-playing system. And if you want to, you know, not use the Cthulhu mythos in any way, and you want to focus on, you know, what you might call traditional folklore monsters like, you know, werewolves and vampires, well, you can do. I mean, you can set up do a version of Dracula or whatever horror film you want to name or fiction, and use the game as a vehicle to do that. And likewise, you know, you want to create your own kind of setup, your own kind of mythos, then again, you know, the game, you know, can accommodate that and does. And in fact, we recently released a new campaign for the game called The Children of Fear, written by a colleague of mine, Lynn Hardy. And that is set in the 1920s, and it's set across China, India, and Tibet. And in the introduction to that campaign, it presents the kind of, you know, who the villains are of the campaign. You know, what's the secret, you know, behind it all, and, you know, what's actually going on that the players have got to discover. And it actually presents it in a number of options for the keeper. And you can do a Cthulhu Mythos option, you know, and that's kind of spelled out. But equally, you can play it without any Cthulhu Mythos involvement and just focus on the kind of the esoteric lore of that particular, you know, of the cultures in that particular region, and play it as a kind of like an occult horror rather than a Cthulhu Mythos horror campaign. So, as I say, it's a versatile kind of setup to allow you to kind of ultimately tell the stories and play the kind of games you want to play. And as you say, you know, it doesn't have to be mystery horror. You can do it as survival horror. You can do a kind of, you know, Walking Dead zombie apocalypse kind of version of the game if you want to. You can do the, you know, One Night of Terror in the Haunted House. You can, you know, whatever kind of version of horror, psychological to shock horror, you know, the game kind of copes with all of those things. And it really comes down to the style and type of game you and your friends who are playing it want to experience, really. And it can be, you know, very safe horror, can be very kind of child friendly and it's kind of almost like a Scooby-Doo game, to, you know, to a much more gritty, dark kind of version of the game with, you know, particularly on the cosmic horror side of things, that is, you know, much more psychological in that sense. And that will all vary on who the players are and, as I say, the kind of game they want to share together. Ultimately, though, it is a game and it is meant to be fun, even if the fun is being scared or the fun is, you know, pretending to be scared. You know, it is a game at the end of the day. And, you know, if you're not having fun, then, you know, something's not quite right. So, you know, we do emphasize that you've got, you know, it should be an enjoyable experience for whatever you're looking to get out of it. You know, that's hopefully what you're going to get out of it.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Hello, I'm Paul Giamatti.
And I'm Stephen Asma.
Each week on Chinwag, we dig into the weird topics you wonder about, that you care about, the stuff none of us are totally sure of, like the Bermuda Triangle, Mothman, consciousness, philosophy, UFOs, ghosts, or, say, Bigfoot.
So who's to say that there's not alien species that are Sasquatch?
Like, I've seen a ghost, and I would hear something walking and breathing.
Maybe every path is right. I will accept as a premise that every path is right.
That is a face on Mars. Eyes, nose. It kind of looked like Wilson the volleyball.
Some people enjoy the waves or whatever crashing, and I enjoy listening to a quantum physics audiobook.
I do think there are many things in the world that we just don't understand and probably won't understand.
That's our whole show.
So join us every Wednesday on all major podcast platforms and find us on Instagram, TikTok, and Twitter at ChinwagPod and Wagon.
Obviously, I don't have any real metrics on this, but I've noticed over the course of the last year with the pandemic, a lot of people have been doing online gaming. Has business been okay for you guys? Or how have gamers been making their library and sanity rolls online?
Yeah, absolutely. With the pandemic, meaning obviously people couldn't get together and face-to-face around a gaming table like, you know, traditionally, you know, you do a role-playing game that way. Everyone has kind of just gone online, and the number and rate of online role playing has skyrocketed over this last 12 plus months. You know, that's Call of Cthulhu, but also the other games we do like RuneQuest and you know, and other gaming companies, you know, D&D and so on. You know, I think everyone is kind of, you know, at the end of the day, role playing for most people is certainly an important hobby for them. And you know, whenever bad things happen in real life, the one thing you try and hold on to before you let it, you know, before it goes is the hobby you love and what you do with your friends in that way. And so people have found ways to do that online, either using a purpose-built kind of role-playing platform like Roll20 or Fantasy Grounds and so on, or just using Zoom or Skype to do an audio-only game or a video, you know, an online video game, or using Discord. There's so many ways to do it. And because Call of Cthulhu isn't a kind of a tactical combat game, you don't actually need to have a battle map and, you know, and representational miniatures to move around on the screen. It's a theatre of the mind. It's telling, you know, a kind of a shared fiction. And so, you know, just your voices and or you know, just, you know, your faces on the video screen. And you know, does the trick really, and it works really well for Call of Cthulhu in that way. So yeah, we've had a good year. You know, we continue to sell books and PDFs and so on, and more people, you know, continue to pick up and play the game. And in fact, we recently, well, we already knew this, but we got it recently reconfirmed, actually, that we have a partner in Japan who is a licensee and produces the, you know, Japanese translation of Call of Cthulhu, and has been doing so for quite a few years now. And we're blown away to find out that Call of Cthulhu is the biggest role-playing game in Japan.
Wow.
And there are, and what's even cooler is that actually the majority of people that play Call of Cthulhu are women in Japan. There's more women playing role-playing games Call of Cthulhu than there are males, which in North America and England it tends to be, you know, the other way around. But the female gamers are certainly the majority for Call of Cthulhu in Japan. And the number of people playing the game far outstrips pretty much the entire world combined in terms of the number of people that are really into it in Japan. But that's the same. South Korea, as well as Europe, you know, France, Spain, Germany, they've all got very healthy communities of Call of Cthulhu players, as well as obviously, you know, the UK and North America and Canada have got, you know, significant numbers of people who get together every week or every month and, you know, fight the good fight against the horrors of Cthulhu and so on.
Wow. Have you by any chance seen the new movie Demon Slayer?
I haven't. No, no.
It's an anime film. My kids just went nuts for the anime series, which is streaming online. I don't know. There's one season of it, but they made this movie, and it's a fascinating world. It's like set in turn of the century, 19th to 20th century Japan. And there's a secret corps of demon slayers who are fabulous swordsmen with magic swords who are hiding among the sort of 1910 to 1915 Japan, hunting down demons. All the demons derive from a single demon who's infecting people. And it's kind of vampiric in nature. But this movie is about the protagonists of the cartoon series hopping on board a train, and then on the train, a demon exists on the train that's using the ability to send people into a dream world and then fight them in their dreams to suck out their life force while they're sleeping. Oh my gosh, it is the most disturbing Lovecraftian thing I've seen in years. It is amazing. And and the visuals fit right into this milieu. I highly recommend it. Although I don't think the film would make a lick of sense if you haven't seen the first season of the show, but it's getting incredible ratings. But I could totally see how this would fit right into a campaign. And I've done homebrew scenarios based on like Evil Dead 2 and Army of Darkness, which I think would probably those would fit into the pulp world, I guess, considering how indestructible Ash is as a protagonist.
Oh, yeah. I mean, yeah, certainly that would work really well. What's making me smile about the what you've just been describing about the Demon Slayer film? It sounds really cool. I would definitely have to check it out. It reminds me, I mean, obviously it's somewhat different, but, you know, there's an epic campaign for Call of Cthulhu, which is called Horror on the Orient Express.
Exactly.
You journey on the Orient Express in the 1920s across Europe, and towards the end of the campaign, you know, the monsters and so forth, they're on the train with you, and there's certainly an episode in that campaign where you I think there's a couple actually where you head into the land of dream and have, you know, nightmares, and what happens in those nightmares can affect you. So there's some similarity and crossover there, which you know, kind of strengthens the kind of the point that maybe is some really cool inspiration to be had from the film to bring into games as well. So that's interesting.
I am fascinated. My children, they've done some tabletop stuff, but a lot of their free time they spend playing, I'm going to air quote, role-playing games on online chat forums where there's no rules. It's everybody's basically doing freestyle. And I'm like, you guys don't understand the rules are awesome. I mean, you know, they have to deal with the occasional player who wants to be overpowered or whatever. But I am fascinated where even without a rule set, people seem to just come up with role-playing as a natural form of play.
I think so. I mean, I think that's really true. And I think it comes back to, you know, I keep saying this, I know, but it is a shared story. And I think it goes back to that, you know, for most of us, we enjoy stories. And, you know, storytelling is a tradition and an art form that goes back, you know, to the very beginnings of humanity in this way. And I think, you know, role-playing is just a different iteration of the same kind of will to tell stories. It's as you say, that kind of shared storytelling experience. You know, you don't necessarily need rules to do it, as you say. It does help when, you know, when you do get into those arguments about whether, you know, who hit who first. But you know, the rules just give it kind of some structure. But I think ultimately it's about, you know, we love telling stories and we love, you know, to collaborate and give each other a sense of wonder, scare each other, amuse each other. And all of these things, you know, come out of storytelling, but they also, you know, they also come out of role-playing too. So I think they're connected in that way. There's some sort of root level.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've described in my own work how important narrative is to literally every culture. Like, there's elements that are repeated inside those cultures in their own different sort of idioms. But the storytelling process itself seems to be a very human thing. I'm not aware of any culture. And I don't know that you can have culture without story. I mean, part of a culture is, like, the boundaries around that culture are defined by stories. So it's a very human thing to do. But I like how role-playing games give a structured sort of play area with... even if the story itself lends itself to madness and chaos, like within that sort of boundary area, you've got rules that you can use within a gaming system to sort of help the play be. And I think without the rules, you couldn't have collaborative storytelling. That's what really helps, I think, is people contribute to the stories using the rules to sort of keep any one single player or person or role or keeper from sort of messing things up, if you will.
Yeah, well, that's right. Yeah, no, it creates a level playing field. And also, to kind of reiterate what you just said, it creates a safe space. It's a safe space to tell a shared story. And, you know, and particularly in the genre that we're working in, which is, you know, horror, a safe space is can be important. You know, I reiterate, it's a game and it's meant to be fun. It's not meant to, you know, we're not looking to, terrify you, the person. We want to terrify your character in the game, but you as a person, we want you to be having fun while your character's being terrified. We don't want you to kind of leave the game, you know, comatose from shock or anything, you know. So it is a safe, you know, a safe space, a safe environment to tell a horror story or whatever that might mean to each group.
Yeah, Call of Cthulhu is. I'm going to ask you to be a historian now. I don't know if you have looked into all of this, but my understanding is Call of Cthulhu is based on the basic role playing system. You mentioned earlier the Avalon Hill. Well, I think of Avalon Hill, but the RuneQuest, and I'm also thinking of Superworld, which if people don't know Superworld. There's a new TV series about wild cards being made, which is a book series also from George R. R. Martin, the guy who did the Game of Thrones series. And unlike Game of Thrones, characters in wild cards tend to die. Go ahead.
It is all circular. Yeah, so RuneQuest is a fantasy role-playing game that on one hand looks a little bit like Dungeons & Dragons, but on the other hand is totally different. It's very much based in mythologies and things like that, and is set in a very detailed game world called Galantha. And in fact, you know, Chaosium, the company, was set up by Greg Stafford originally in the 70s as a way to publish his Galantha stories through games. And, you know, in fact, the first game we ever produced was a board game set in Galantha. And then RuneQuest, a role-playing game, followed. And then in 1981, around Halloween, which will be 40 years old this year come Halloween, Call of Cthulhu came out. And they are all of our games, you know, traditionally have been modeled on what is called the basic role-play system, BRP. And so they all work on a percentile-based dice system, a D100. So, you know, your characters have skills. So, say, you know, you can climb a wall at 70%. You roll a percentile dice, and if you get 70% or lower, you've climbed the wall okay. There's no problems, basically. And so it's quite an intuitive system because, you know, we all understand percentages in terms of saying, well, I'm only 10% good in driving my car. That means I'm probably not that good about driving my car. So it's very intuitive that way. But it's all kind of based on that basic role play system, and each game kind of takes that core system and then kind of remodels it for the mechanics needed for a certain style of play. So the RuneQuest mechanics are very much more about combat and using, you know, characters using magic and shamanistic magic, particularly in the game world, whereas Call of Cthulhu is more about investigation and running away and occasional magic use, but the magic is very different to the magic you get in the fantasy world. So they all kind of have a common heritage, but go their own kind of ways with it. in terms of the game system.
There is always something so peculiar about Glorantha, though. It's like one of the most brutal and realistic combat worlds to feature talking fantasy ducks, I think, out there.
Yeah, that's what the true role of chaos within the Glorantha world is. What's more chaotic than a talking duck? I think it's got analogies to that line. Who is it that said, if you woke up one morning and your cat and dog started speaking to you, you'd go mad. I can't remember who said it now, but that is
someone wise, because it's totally true. Now, Lovecraft has kind of had a cultural bump lately. I think a lot of people are at least name aware because of the HBO series Lovecraft Country, based on the novel by Matt Ruff. Do you think that had any impact on the sort of growth of the gaming community?
I honestly don't know. I think back in the 80s, the Call of Cthulhu game and the films of, you know, like Reanimator and From Beyond did a lot to kind of awareness of, you know, Lovecraft stories. I think, you know, that tends to be common wisdom, you know, on the academic side in terms of, you know, how Lovecraft's fiction and Lovecraft Circle have become better known, and the kind of, you know, the Cthulhu meme in terms of, you know, Cthulhu plushie dolls and that kind of thing. I think they had their start in the early 80s, but certainly I think this new bump, which I think is brilliant, in the last few years, we've had this bump in kind of almost in reaction to Lovecraft as a, you know, make no bones about it, as a man in the 1920s and 30s, he was, you know, he was a racist, and some of his fiction, you know, is unpleasant in that terms. But, you know, like many, you know, historical fiction writers, we can still, you know, enjoy the stories and the ideas in terms of what, you know, the creativity and the positive side of that work, while still, you know, understanding that the actual person that wrote them is somebody, you know, you probably wouldn't want round for dinner in that way. And certainly, you know, Lovecraft's no different to people, you know, Robert E. Howard and so forth, who may have had views we wouldn't necessarily agree with these days. Or even then, really. And so this kind of bump with Lovecraft Country, and we've seen, you know, new voices and a really kind of diverse set of voices really now coming to kind of respond to Lovecraft.
Yeah.
And so that's new energy to it and new light on, you know, some of the original kind of material and the ideas of the Cthulhu mythos, and really, you know, opening that up for a wider audience and interpretation. So, you know, not just Matt Ruff, but we've had Victor LaSalle, who did
LaVal, yeah. Yeah, the Ballad of Black Tom. I have to say about, yeah, Victor LaVal, I don't know if he still listens to the show, but he used to at least listen to the show, and he kindly mentioned us in a New York Times review, which I just absolutely love.
Oh, wow.
But the Ballad of Black Tom is such a beautiful retelling of the horror at Red Hook, flipping everything on his head. It's so good, yeah.
I'm a big fan of that, and I just think, you know, it's high time that, you know, a wider selection of diverse voices, you know, not only in fiction and new media like, you know, TV series and films, but also, you know, coming into role playing. So I work with a number of people and encourage people to, you know, write for role playing games who come from, you know, different cultures and different backgrounds to me, certainly, who can bring, you know, new eyes and new thoughts to the, not only to the game, but to the, you know, the heritage of the game and the scenarios and campaigns. So you know, I think that's all, you know, it makes everything stronger and you know, great and interesting, to be honest. So I think, you know, more the merrier in that way, I think.
You know, another thing that's happened recently was the Stranger Things, which made, at least during season one, Dungeons and Dragons was a big part of the show. Are you disappointed or annoyed that everybody in fictional media only plays D&D? You never see Traveler or Rifts or GURPS or Call of Cthulhu or any of like the many, many other games out there.
There are many, many other games. And I mean, you know, sometimes it's just the easy banana to pick, isn't it? The Dungeons and Dragons is synonymous with role-playing games because it was, you know, the first in that, in kind of public consciousness. However, Yeah, it'd be nice to see, as you say, Traveller or Call of Cthulhu or many other games getting some representation as well.
I mean, it's not a direct thing, but I mean, even like the popularity of the Fallout series after Fallout. Well, those were all pretty GURPS derivative. I mean, you know, so it surprises me so many people know Fallout but don't know anything about GURPS, for example.
Sure.
So weird. Cool.
Yeah. No, I mean, the thing is with role-playing games is a very vibrant and diverse hobby in that sense of, you know, there's whatever genre or kind of things you want to kind of explore within role-playing, but it's out there or will be, you know, whether it's a very kind of light kind of, you want to kind of do a kind of a Studio Ghibli kind of style of game, you know, with an anime kind of sensibility, there's a game for that.
Welcome to My Neighbor Nyarlathotep.
Yeah, or you're into kind of, you know, UK comics and you love Judge Dredd in 2000 AD. Well, there's a game for that as well, and you know, there's a bit of everything everywhere, and it's just finding your niche and what you enjoy most. All of us into role playing, we all end up playing many different types of games, and you know, we normally have our favorite or the one we always come back to. But you know, there's many games to try, and it's just cool that, you know, at the moment that, you know, a lot of people have been, you know, trying out new games and continuing campaigns because of, you know, online play through the pandemic. And it'll be great, and hopefully, you know, people will continue to play and people will continue to come to role playing and enjoy a bit of fun, which is like I keep saying, what it's all about.
It is, and I think this is a great way to get started. So if someone wants to try out the Malleus Monstrorum with their gaming, what's a good way to get started with the sort of Call of Cthulhu system? What do you recommend people begin with?
There's two routes of entry really into the game. It's actually three, but I'll mention the two key ones. The obvious one is we make a box set, and it's called the Call of Cthulhu Starter Set, and it does exactly what it says on the box. It's a starter set. If you've never played Call of Cthulhu, or if you've never role-played before, it will take you through three books that are coming in the box set, and it will take you what is role-playing, how to play the game, how to learn to game, until by the end of the box, you will be able to run the game for your friends. And in fact, the first book you open is a solo choose your own adventure. So you start, you can go home, open the box, and you can begin playing on your own straight away. And as you play that adventure, it will actually teach you the rules as you play it. And it's a really cool little adventure. Some slightly reminiscent in some parts of The Wicker Man. And so it's very, very cool and fun. But it basically, that box will really set you up and really get you, you know, to enjoy the game, and hopefully, you know, something that you want to continue further. The other way to do it is even cheaper than that. We have a quick start, Call of Cthulhu Quick Start rule set, which is a small booklet that you can download for free from chaosium.com. That will give you a kind of the basic rules and a single adventure for you to, you know, to run for your friends. And you know, if you're already a role player but you've just not tried Call of Cthulhu before, then I would point you at the quick start, because it's a very cheap and easy way to just give a kind of a taste for the game. If you're newer to role playing, I would certainly suggest the Call of Cthulhu starter set, and because that gives you everything you need to get going, really. Beyond those, there's the Call of Cthulhu Keeper rulebook, which is the actual main core rulebook of the game, which is the foundation of everything else beyond there. And then on from there, there's numerous supplements, campaigns, adventures, settings, and so forth. And the Malleus is, you know, one of those support books for the game. And they're all available through, you know, from chaosium.com or your friendly local gaming store or your online retailer like Amazon or whoever. And they're all available. The beauty is, if you buy from Chaosium or Drive-Thru RPG, you can buy the physical print of the books or the PDFs, but if you buy the physical print, you get the PDFs for free as well. And so it's kind of an added value thing there as well. But, you know, if you just want to know a little bit more before you dive into anything, then chaosium.com is our website, and there's information on our pages about Call of Cthulhu, what the game is, what's it all about, what you can get, and free downloads and all that kind of thing. And is a good, you know, just a good place to sort of dive in and have a look, really.
Outstanding. So now, I don't know if you've listened to much Monster Talk, but our signature question that we ask guests to finish out an interview is this: what's your favorite monster? But I don't want you to feel constrained, like in any way, to like limit yourself to the Cthulhu mythos. Although I should mention, we didn't mention it, the book includes cryptids as one of the categories of monsters. So you could, which I think, by the way, I should mention here, is extremely appropriate considering that Lovecraft's Mego, which is a beloved monster for Cthulhu, Call of Cthulhu players, the Mego is actually a word used to describe the creature we call the Abominable Snowman, like the Yeti. Like that's actually from Lovecraftian writing. So that's kind of an impressive tie-in with the world of cryptozoology.
It certainly is. Because in Animalius, there is, you have the Mego, the kind of the alien monsters that Lovecraft was kind of talking about. But we also, as you say, in the cryptid section, have Sasquatch and Abominable Snowman as well, because, we have, you know, spooky black phantom dogs and corpse lights and all that kind of thing.
By the way, yes. I noticed that your black dog had one eye, which reminded me of the Usborne Book of Ghosts, which also included a...
You know me so well.
Yeah.
I'm gonna answer your actual question, and it's gonna relate in this wonderful whole circle of life that I think you're gonna appreciate. Because my favorite monster is Jeff the Talking Mongoose. I first learned about in the Usborne, you know, world of ghosts and strangeness.
Ooh, me
and,
too.
And I've always been fascinated by Jeff. And I know, because I do listen to the show, and I know that you know who Jeff is, and you've talked about the Usborne books and so on. So yeah, it all kind of circles back for me to that as well. And in fact, I'm holding in my hands Jeff, the Strange Tale of the Extra Special Talking Mongoose. Have you read that?
I have not read the whole thing. I've read pieces. This is by Christopher Joseph, right? And he was on our show. Yeah. No, it's I need to set aside some time and actually finish the book. But yes, it is, well, obviously the most complete look at the topic, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there's any stone he didn't unturn in the whole, all of the research for that. So
it's so funny you would mention this, because for me, the great mystery of Lovecraft is whether or not the character of Brown Jinkin from Dreams in the Witch House is so reminiscent of Jeff. I just have to wonder, it happened at the right time. It could have been based on Jeff. I just don't know. There's no proof that Jeff appeared in the newspapers at the time in Providence or in that area. So I just would love to know for sure if Lovecraft was inspired by that.
I think, it seems so plausible that it was. I mean, this, as you say, there's no one as yet has found any evidence to say that it definitely was, but I think in my heart I'd like to think that possibly it was, because it just seems so, you know, such a natural link between the two, and just wouldn't it be cool if that was actually the case. So I choose to believe it was.
That is lovely. It would make perfect sense. It's kind of fun to imagine Lovecraft reading a newspaper account or listening to the wireless and hearing a story of it. It's just like knowing he overlaps so heavily with Nendorf Hodor and Harry Price. It's like, those guys, both of those guys would have fit right in with his stories, I think. I think that would have been a
problem. Well, absolutely. I mean, I finished reading the book, and I was actually going to a games convention the following weekend, and I wasn't sure what to run. So I just ended up running a version of Jeff, the role-playing game for Call of Cthulhu, for this session. I actually changed it from a mongoose to a strange squirrel-like creature. I didn't call him Jeff. I had it on the Isle of Man, but I just didn't, you know, I just changed some of the names and so forth. and but this had it convoluted into the Cthulhu mythos for the game, and that went pretty well. It was great. It was good fun, and yeah, it kind of gave me the idea for a book that we're going to bring out, not yet, but down the road.
Yeah, it's not a big jump from the Vorish sign to the Voiry sign, so yeah, that makes sense.
We're going to do a collection of Call of Cthulhu scenarios, you know, using the premise of folk horror and kind of, you know, where the Cthulhu mythos may be involved, but it's a kind of a watered down version almost, and is much more focused on the kind of the tradition of, you know, folk horror. So whether, you know, Jeff might make some sort of appearance in that, perhaps, who knows, we'll see what happens.
It's so fun because it's like just that sort of 1920s, 1930s venue, like for as far as a role-playing world, you get rid of so many of the things that ruin horror later. Like you know, so many people position their horror in the 1980s, so there's no cell phones, right? I mean, just, sure. Just that little kind of thing can sort of break things. But yeah, Lovecraft was working in like modern, he was almost writing sci-fi at the time.
Yes, and, yeah, he was writing contemporary for himself. And I mean, I always say, you know, don't fear the cell phone and modern technology, embrace it in the horror. Because whilst, you know, I think in one sense, you know, having all your characters having cell phones, it's great because it means they can all keep in touch. And that's wonderful. That actually helps to speed things along and keep the game moving. But equally, you can use the phones and the internet to create horror. You can,
absolutely, you know, when the phone rings, yeah.
And some strange voices on the end of it telling you things they shouldn't know about you. Uh-huh. That's pretty scary.
It is. And the Japanese are doing the best job at that lately, it seems like to me, just taking technology and just making it absolutely terrifying. Things they're doing with cell phones and, you know, a call comes in from a number you don't recognize or a website you don't understand. They're doing a lot of things in Japanese horror to sort of remind you that technology is no protection against the chaos of the universe. And I think that's a lovely, lovely message.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that fits the game perfectly. Absolutely.
Absolutely. All right. Well, I don't want to keep you all day, but I really loved this book. It was lovely. It's gotten me fired up to pull out my gaming books and give it a shot. I haven't played in a while. I almost always end up being the game master. But I, you know, I think it was second or third edition talked about the importance of the onion when you tell a story. Yeah. Like, no matter what you dig down to, if you think you've reached the bottom, you're wrong. That's just the next layer of the onion. And I've always taken that to heart with my homebrew scenarios. I just love it that people can think they've solved things and they've only scratched the surface. And that's fantastic.
Absolutely. No, that's the kind of core advice we still have in the rule book about, you know, your mystery is an onion and, you know, each clue takes away one layer, but there's always a layer beyond it.
Exactly. There is no bottom. Yeah.
You get deeper in the revelation and the horror just gets deeper and harder and more frightening.
Yeah.
So, yeah. No, it's a great little tool to think about when you're running games. So yeah, well, I hope you do get a chance to you know, put the gaming hat on again and even, you know, do a little bit here and there. And
yeah.
Certainly, you know, the lack of, you know, venues and physicality is certainly not a hindrance these days. And there's plenty of, you know, role-playing game forums online and, you know, specific ones for whatever game you're looking for, and certainly the ones for Call of Cthulhu where, you know, people will post, you know, I've not been playing for a while, I'd love to join a game, is there a one-shot? And the community is very welcoming and very supportive. And I see numerous people kind of, you know, wanting to give the game a try or just get into it again and posting up, and they're inundated with invites to, you know, do you want to come and play my game tonight or whatever it may be. So, you know, there's certainly a lot of opportunity to just give things a go without, you know, without getting too deeply involved and just to, you know, test the water, as it were. And certainly I'd, you know, recommend, you know, people just give it a go if it sounds something that they would be interested in.
Yeah, so. Absolutely. And what we'll do is obviously we'll put a link to the Malleus Monstrorum in the show notes, as well as the starter kit and some of the other material you have Where would you like people to like link to? You want them to go to the Chaosium site or to DriveThruRPG or Amazon or where?
Yeah, just if you send us, chaosium.com is a great place to start. And, we've got presence on Twitter and Facebook, and I'm on Twitter and Facebook and so forth. So, wherever you go, whether it's chaosium.com or you find your way to us through DriveThru or wherever it is, we all interconnect. We are like the old ones. We are all interconnected, and you will find us out eventually.
All right. That's fantastic. Well, Mike, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us today on Monster Talk. I really appreciate it. And what year did you join Chaosium?
I've been, 7 years I've been full-time at Chaosium looking after Cthulhu. Prior to that, I worked freelance and worked for other games companies. But 7 years, so 7 years. But I've been playing it since it came out in about 1981. So
yeah, wow. So I think I picked it up in 88 myself. I think that's when I started. And but I had read Lovecraft long before that when I was in middle school, I've mentioned it before. I'll mention it again. People ask me, well, if you're going to start with Lovecraft, what do you think the best book to begin with is? And I always say a dictionary. but once you get beyond his vocabulary choices, I think there's a lot to be enjoyed there. So, and this game is a great way to take that enjoyment to the next level and make it part of your own imaginary experience, which is just so much fun. So I really appreciate it, and thank you for all you guys do over there. It's just so many hours of fun playing Chaosium products, so I really appreciate you guys talking to me today.
Oh, no, it's been an absolute pleasure, Blake, and thank you very much for the invite to come on and talk games and Cthulhu with you. It's a privilege, so thank you very much.
Did you actually answer the question? You went with Jeff the Talking Mongoose, didn't you? Okay.
Cool. I did go, yes.
Yeah. All right, so, okay, just making sure. I was like, all right, no, fantastic choice, for sure. All right.
thanks again. It's been lovely to talk to you.
And, likewise.
I'm a fan of the show, it's been a real pleasure for me to just shoot the breeze, so
fantastic. Well, this has all been good stuff. Maybe one day I'll get to the UK as well. It'll happen. I'm sure of it. All right.
Oh, sure. Yeah. Well, take care. And I'll hopefully speak to you again soon.
All right. Sounds good. See ya.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
Today, you heard an interview with Mike Mason of Chaosium discussing the new 2-volume Monster Encyclopedia for the role-playing game Call of Cthulhu. Links to the books and many other things that we talked about are in our show notes. Check them out. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones, and we love Kindle so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Monster Talk theme music is by Peach Stealing Monkeys. As always, thank you for listening.
This has been a Monster House presentation.